are about to introduce you to a basic communication skill. It's called blending. And blending builds trust. That's the whole point of it. It's a way of building a bridge between yourself and another person. And, you know, rather than saying a lot about it, I'd love to demonstrate it to you. I'd like to just let you see what blending looks like. And, Rick, I could use your help. I want to do a blending demonstration.
I'm not sure I can do that right now.
Come on, man. This is the wrong place for you to say that. Okay, everybody's watching. You're
embarrassing. I know, but no, you didn't understand. I didn't get to tell you, but the guy, and he called, and it's going
to
be...
That has nothing to do with anything.
Well, it's got a lot to do with...
No, I'm sorry. We're trying to do a blending demo, and you're being really difficult.
No, I'm really taking care of some important business that we
take care
of.
What is your problem? Why would you... I can't
it's
believe it.
It's not a problem. I mean...
I don't... You know... You
well, you're like never missed a business. And
yeah, okay, great. You know what? Never mind.
Fine.
So that would be an example of not blending. Let's try this another way. Hey. What are you doing?
Waiting for the right moment.
Oh, yeah. Moments are funny like
some
that.
Just go by so fast.
They do. It's amazing. And then
and
you
others,
get the ones
like,
that
take
are little,
forever.
Yeah. Hey, I could use your help.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd be happy to help you, but I don't think I can right now.
Oh, you can't help me right now?
No, I got this thing I didn't get to tell
you. You got a thing?
Right, and it's an important thing.
Yeah, I
important
know
to you, too, but because
oh.
I had
oh,
a break, I didn't
cool.
get a chance to let you know.
Oh, well, thanks for letting me know.
Oh, yeah,
I wouldn't
sure.
want to get in the way of the thing. But this will go
really
quick. I
appreciate that you appreciate the importance of the thing.
I do. But, you know, if you help me out, it'll go really quick, and you'll have time to
go. Oh, really?
Yeah,
well,
promise.
How quick would it really go?
As quick as you need it to go.
Well, I mean, I really only have a minute at the
you
moment.
You got a minute? We'll get it done in a minute.
Like, literal minute?
Literal minute.
Okay. What
okay,
are you waiting
cool.
for? Let's go.
In fact, we already did it. That's
oh,
it.
Okay.
Nicely done.
Yeah. That was good.
That's what blending is all about. Do you get it? It's a basic communication skill. And basically what it means is reducing differences between yourself and another person. Said another way, it's about sending signals of similarity. And the good news is you all know how to do this. And the bad news is it's the last thing you think of doing when you most need to do it. Because it's what you do. Well, wait a minute. I'm making a huge assumption. I'm assuming you have at least one friend. Is that accurate? If you have at least one friend, I promise you, you know how to blend. That's how you build your relationships every time. You reduce differences, send signals of similarity. How many of you have been remember meeting the person you fell in love with and finding things in common? You remember that where you're like, me too, me too. Remember that moment? Me too. Some of you even wanted to be with them so much you lied a bit. Like, you're like, yeah, me too. We'll work that out in therapy. I just want to be with you. That's it. Well, that's blending, and that's a natural instinct, a natural impulse when you care about someone in a deep way or when you share with somebody a mission or an objective. But the problem is with problem people, you're not like them, and you don't want to be like them, and that's where blending seems to be a little difficult. So here's the basic rule of relationship. I want you to remember this for the rest of the day because it explains a lot of your problems with problem people. The basic rule of human relationship goes like this. No one cooperates with anyone who seems to be against them. And that's exactly what people assume if they're not actively getting the signals, I'm with you, I'm with you, I'm with you. I want you to hear this because I'm telling you right now, in every moment, of every relationship, no matter how long you've been together with somebody or how little you know them, in every moment, every one of us is looking and listening for an answer to one question. You with me? You with me? We want to know. You with me? We want to know. Are you? Are you? We want to know. And if we don't get the signal, yeah, I'm with you, the default assumption is you must be against me. There's no lukewarm in human relationships. You're either with me or you're not. And that's the problem with problem people. You're not like them. You don't want to be like them. And that's the nonverbal message you're sending. I'm not like you. I don't like you. You're on your own. And then you wonder why there's no cooperation. Blending builds trust. It's a place where you can meet people where they are. It's a matter of knowing what to blend with. Rick, how about a remote?
So
do the thing.
The thing. So now, let's go back in time. To UCLA, 1967. A professor named Albert Morabian does an experiment. He makes a film with some people communicating. He then takes the soundtrack off the film, runs it through a synthesizer, makes words incomprehensible, but leaves tone, volume, and speed intact. He then has a transcript prepared that's actually said. He gathers a group of people. He shows them the film. Then he plays soundtrack, no words, no images, just... Then he hands out the transcript, lets people read it. Most people think this is three different interactions. That's a business meeting. Those people are angry. These are obviously good friends. They're shocked to learn no. All the same interaction. He says, so what do you think is really going on? And based on their responses, he concludes that 55% of the meaning we make in any communication is based on how it looks to us. 38% is based on how that sounds to us, and 7% is based on the actual words that are spoken. And this is what we will affectionately refer to as the 55, 38, and 7. Now, consider this. Seeing is believing, 55%. Action speaks louder than words, 55%. How many of you remember the show Candid Camera? How many do not? How many wouldn't raise your hand no matter what we ask you? Just in case anybody knows, it's a strange situation with a hidden camera. They see what ordinary people will do with that. When they got off network TV, went to videotape, they could get more outrageous. They took over a doctor's waiting room, hired a bunch of actors and actresses, sit around the waiting room reading magazines, waiting for the doctor. Except these people are dressed only in their underwear. Real patients came in, men and women, are shocked, and in 30 seconds they undress, hang up their clothes, pick up a magazine, wait for the doctor. They'll try it sometimes, see what happens. Typical people won't bother you. 55%, I see it, it must be so. 38%, the way things sound is less, but is it really less important? No. Tone of voice is going to be taken more personally than any other part of our communication. 7% words, that's a lot less, but then again, less important? No. We all know one word can be a buzzword or a trigger. Here's an example. You know, it was about 7 years ago, I hit a milestone. I had the glasses to read for the first time. Really bummed me out, but I decided I'll cross that line with dignity. In fact, just like Captain Kirk. In case you don't recall, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. Kirk was allergic to Retinac, so he had to get half reading glasses. But he still beat Khan, who was a genetically superior being. We're talking Ricardo Montalban here. So, I'm in the glasses store trying to make the best of it. I try an old half-reading glasses, and then I say to my wife, so what do you think? Do I look like Captain Kirk? She says, I say what? I think they look okay. The salesman there says, yes, I think you look very professorial. Ooh, professorial. I turn back to my wife, and she says, I think you look like an old guy. I look to the salesman. He says, I think you look distinguished. You hear the power of one word? Who am I going home with tonight? In airports all around the country, they're trying to figure out what should you say, 7%. How should it be said, 38%, that's going to keep people from leaving in cars and loading zones in front of terminals once and for all. Now, traditionally, it's voice of authority, which is a man who says,
please do not park in a loading zone. Violators will be cited and towed.
Yeah, a lot of people are intimidated by that. So in Burbank, California, a woman named Marilyn says,
please do not park in the loading zone. Violators will have to be cited and towed. We thank you for helping keep traffic moving. We'd rather see you leave here with a smile than a ticket.
She's more friendly. She explains why it's good. It's California. Works really well in Portland, Oregon, where I've been living for the last 32 years, is a woman comes on and says,
it would support the environment if you didn't leave your car here.
And works best in my hometown, where I grew up in New York City. A guy comes on and says,
yo, pal, you leave your car, it's going to be stolen.
55, 38, 7. It's all important. What the numbers are really telling us is what's going to happen when there's a mixed message. Tell me something. You ever been a customer? Has anybody ever been customer serving you and they say, have a nice day? Now, do you think they care? Well, why not? Didn't they say the magic words? Have a nice day. The way it sounds does not match. Whenever there's a mismatch, we go with the higher number. Now, when you are successful communicating to people, you send what's called congruent messages. That means all your channels are going in exactly the same direction. And one of the most common ways we create a problem for ourselves that does not have to be there is the mixed message, where we got a channel going off in a different direction than the other two. And the place this tends to happen the most is between how it sounds and what gets said. That's because the major component of how it sounds is tone, voice tone. Tone reflects emotional state. Wherever you are emotionally will come out through your tone. Conscious mind is picking the concepts you're trying to get across to the other person that will be encoded in this symbol system that we call language and words. So the trap is we could be feeling something's got nothing to do with the person we're interacting with, so we suppress where we are, we pick the message we want, but then the emotional state leaks out a little bit through the tone, and all of a sudden, people are ignoring the words, only responding to the tone. This happened to me a few years ago when I had a car that would not start. I pushed it to a dealership. I say, make it start. $800 later, this car theoretically works. So I lock it up in the Portland airport, long-term parking, go off on a trip, come back 3 days later, weather's changed, it's freezing rain, I have no coat, no sweater, and umbrella. I wait for the bus, long-term parking, it never comes. Finally, there's nothing to do but get wet. I walk out there, get soaking wet, freezing. Let's get in the car. The heat on, and it's dead. I am not in the best of moods. But it's times like that I thank God for AAA. There's an organization I love, been a member 42 years, would not leave home without it. That point is even better because I had just signed up for AAA Plus. I had no idea what the plus stood for. But I got it because of the last AAA guy, who was such a compelling communicator. He says to me, fella, not trying to sell you anything, but let me be honest with you. You got to get yourself AAA Plus. Because if you had AAA Plus, I'd be serving you cappuccino right now. We come with a masseuse, a table. Oh, yeah, that's good. Okay, so this is before cell phones. It's a really long, wet way to get back to the terminal. It's a short, wet way over to the office connected to the toll booth. I can't believe they're going to let me in their office. They collect money. I'm going to hope for Good Samaritan. So I make my way to the toll booth office. Sure enough, the door is locked. There's a window in the door. A face appears. "55%, wet cat syndrome wins out. They let me in, let me use the phone. They even gave me a little saucer of milk. I get on the phone with AAA. It's normal procedure. What's your number, your problem, location? Fine, we'll have a tow truck out there in 15 to 30 minutes. Please wait. Now, where are they going to tell you to wait? By your car, in your car, at your car. Prepositions vary to a degree, but it's you in your car. That's all I've ever heard until that day when she says, and maybe this is plus. Please wait by the entrance to the parking lot. I'm thinking it's warm, it's dry. I got the... Wait a second, I'm at the exit. Toll booth is exit. Entrance is way on the other side of this lot. There is no shelter there, just a gate that gives you a ticket. I say, I'd rather wait in my car. She says, I'm sorry, I cannot send a tow truck there. I say, why? Is this a legal thing with the Port of Portland? It's not a legal thing, it's just that he won't find you. He won't find me. He'll find me. I'm in row D31, long-term parking. Here's my license plate number. I'll be in my car. She says, oh, no. Now I'm thinking to myself, if the guy knows the alphabet and can count, I'm pretty sure he's going to find me. And as I mentally review my history with AAA, I realize I've never been this specific. I've had times growing up in New York City. They say, where are you? I say, I don't know. All the street signs and even the lampposts are gone. Okay, what's on the corner? Pizza, candy store? That in 10 million corners? They always said, tell you what, get in the car, lock the doors, crouch real low. We'll find you. They've always found me in 15 or 30 minutes. So here I'm saying D31. I'm thinking, hey, these are coordinates, baby. I've seen people beam onto starships with this kind of information. But that's at express, that's suppressed. I just say, yes, he will. She says, no, he won't. I say, yes, he will. She says, no, he won't. I say, yes, he will. Woo. Now, she must have communication training because she got flexible. Let's start from the very beginning. I'm thinking good because we got off on the wrong foot. Where would you like to wait? I said, in my car. And she said, then call me up later when you decide. Okay. So she's taking me personally. Now, if you ever give people a negative message with your tone, the only chance you have to recover from it, get back on track, is you've got to actually be more honest with them and explain what's really going on. So being a professional, flexible communicator, I explained to her what's really going on. Look, I am sorry if I sound angry. That's because I am. It's got nothing to do with you. It has to do with being soaking wet and freezing. I just got a car. I spent $800 to get started last week, and now it doesn't start. And on top of that, you are telling me I must stand in a freezing rain for 15 to 30 minutes with no coat or umbrella because your guy will not find me. Can we just re-examine the situation one more time, just maybe a little more closely? There is only one airport in the whole city of Portland. Do you think he'll find that? It only has one lot called long-term parking, so he'll probably find that. There is only one row in that lot with a pole stuck in the middle of it and a sign on the pole that says D31. To make it easier on the guy, they only put 50 spaces in any particular row, and there's only 3 cars parked in D31. So, if you still think he will not find me, you feel free to tell him it's the car with a really pissed off guy in it! I guess I don't like plus. What does the plus stand for? Plus inconvenience? And she thought that was funny too. So I got approved by upper management, they found me. Now, the turning point. The turning point in that conversation was when I told her where I was coming from. Now, get the irony here. At that point, I got totally condescending with her. I attacked her. I sniped at her. And she's going, that's kind of funny, isn't it? A moment before, when it really had nothing to do with her, she's completely taken it personally. As soon as I told her where I was really coming from and even made it about her, she drops taking it personally. And that's the irony about tone. Beware tone. It's the most common way we create a mixed message and create a problem for herself that doesn't have to be there. Now, obviously, your initial goal is always to give positive messages with your tone. That's what you're trying to do. But we are going to be emotional creatures, and you'll be feeling things. So as a communicator, you want to monitor that. And if you notice your tone is going off in a different direction, then your words are basically non-existent. When it comes to rock, paper, scissor tone words, tone crushes words, and they become non-existent. So let's look at blending and all these forms.
That was too funny.
Too funny? You think I should back off?
Yeah, you should back off, Rick. It was too funny. Less funny. So when we talk about blending, we're talking about the 55% first. And if you're human and they're human, you can do this and so can they. And it works basically like this. We're trying to reduce differences and send signals of similarity. We're talking about things like body posture. That means that if you're sitting and they're standing, what's one simple way to reduce the difference between you? Stand up. If they're sitting and you're standing, what's one simple way to reduce the difference between you? Sit down to talk with them. Get on the same level. That's reducing differences in body posture. And it turns out that this kind of message, this little thing, can make a huge difference. However, there's a caveat. If you're sitting and they're standing and they're hostile and aggressive, I would advise not standing, doing one of the other things that we're about to talk about. For example, how about animation? How many of you have noticed that some people are more animated than others? You know, some people talk with their hands, for example. Any of you know people that do this? I mean, some people are really good at this. They actually show you how many words are in their sentences, highlight the important parts, and punctuate. And then you have people that do not talk with their hands. They talk with their mouth. How many of you know people that that's the only part of them that gets involved when they talk? Unless they're Sam Donaldson, and then they have one eyebrow that gets involved. I grew up watching this guy on TV. This was Sam Donaldson, happy, mad, sad, glad, frustrated, disappointed, excited. It didn't change. Now, here's the problem. If you're one of these people, and you're talking to one of these people, or if you're one of these people, and you're talking to one of these people, you're going to make stuff up about each other. You are. You're going to read something into that. This person's going to look at this person and think, what a stick in the mud. And this person's going to look at this person and think, he's on drugs.
But what we want you to think is, what are they doing and how can I reduce the differences between us? And animation is one of those ways. So I always tell people, look, if you're a highly animated communicator and the person you're talking to isn't, get a handle on that. Calm that down so they can hear your words. And if you're one of these people talking to an animated communicator, every once in a while, force yourself, go. Now I want you to repeat after me. In matters of communication, a little goes a long way. Go ahead. I want you to remember that, because if you do too much of this stuff, it's downright annoying. I'll tell you how I learned it. It was back when I was in med school. I was in my third year of med school, and I met a fellow who was the head of the OBGYN department at St. Vincent's Hospital, and he became my mentor. And one of the things that he insisted that I learn about was this blending idea. He says, think about it. Doctor-patient relationship is doomed from the get-go. It really is. All the differences between the doctor and the patient, no wonder patient compliance is so terrible. When the doctor meets a patient, doctor's usually standing, patient's usually sitting. Doctor has all this personal and private information about the patient. Patient knows nothing about the doctor. Doctor will call the patient by the first name. Patient would never dream of calling the doctor by the first name. Doctor is usually wearing clothing. Patient's wearing paper. Everybody see the problem. There's no common ground there. So when I learned this, I'm an overachiever. I went way too far, which is the way I tend to find the boundary. I put a chair behind the reception desk in the clinic where I was working. And when a new patient came in, I pulled out the chair, sat down across from them. I got their folder with all the information, but I went, hi, I'm Rick Kirshner. I'm your doctor. Your name is? I know their name. But I want them to say theirs. I showed you mine. You show me yours. And the guy did, and he looked a little confused. And I said, all right, you know, we're going to go down to the examining room and see what the problem is. Now, I later found out what the problem was. He had a splinter in his foot. He came to get it removed. I did not know that, but it made him limp. So we limped down to the examining room, because I thought you're supposed to do it all, right? We get down to the examining room, and he takes a seat, and I take a seat. And he crosses his arms, and I cross my arms. And he folds his legs, and I fold my legs. I do know that's a mixed message, just wondering if you're paying attention. Then he leaned forward, I leaned forward. He tipped his head, I tipped my head. He tipped it the other way, I tipped mine. He raised one eyebrow, I raised one eyebrow. He goes, hey, I said, what? He said, are you mocking me? I said, no, I'm blending with you. And he said, well, stop it. And I was like, all right. And I learned something that day. I learned that if you do too much of this with people, it's really annoying. So in matters of communication, a little goes a long way. This is a matter of sending signals, not becoming them. Okay? Because if I'm you and you're you, that's called an identity crisis. And then like, well, who am I supposed to be? So blending with body posture animation, and then there's facial expressions. Because how many of you know we're highly reactive to facial expressions? You ever smile at somebody that didn't smile back? Remember your reaction to that? You're like, well, I'll never smile at them again. You ever been in pain and somebody stood there grinning at you? I think we call that customer service. Now, what I'm saying is, if somebody's in pain, wipe the goofy grin off your face and look like you care. That's basically the idea of it. And if you're having a terrible day and somebody you're dealing with seems to be having a better day, don't fake a smile. We know when somebody's faking a smile. Very few muscles are involved in a fake smile. Lots of muscles are involved in the real deal. But what you can do is make sense out of your behavior the way Rick described with the AAA person, where you say, look, I'm having a really rough day, nothing personal, but how can I help you? Now they know what's going on. They don't have to read anything into it. You've relieved them of that burden. That's actually a signal that's kind of similarity. Blending with the 55%. Now that brings us to the 38%. In addition to tone, we're talking about such things as voice tempo and voice volume. Because it turns out that some people are fast talkers and some people are slow talkers. How many of you know people that are really fast talkers? How many of you know people that talk so fast you find yourself wondering how do they find time to think about what they're going to say next? I mean, they're talking that fast. How do they keep their mouth lubricated at that speed? I've always wondered that. And then you have people that are not fast talkers. They are slow talkers, and the fast talkers fill in the blanks for them because they have a life they'd like to return to. The basic idea here is if you're a naturally fast-talking person, here's how you know you're talking too fast. This is exactly how you'll know. You'll have this thought. How many times do I have to tell them this? And the answer isn't one more unless you do what? Slow it down. But if you're somebody who talks more, no, deliberately, don't you hate when you guess the wrong word? Let's say,
Notice what happens in the room. I don't know if you can hear it, but rustling has begun. If I kept that going about 2 minutes longer, half the people in this room would be like cats fleeing a burning building. I gotta get out of here, I can't take it. And what I'm saying is if you're a naturally slow-talking person, you've got to pick up the pace a little bit with some people, or they grow frustrated, impatient with you, cut you off, treat you badly, and that's the problem. But I had a guy walk up to me after hearing me say this, and he said, I'm going to just tell you what he said because it takes too long. He said, I can't talk fast. And my response was, I noticed that. And it got me thinking about what's the hang-up? What's the problem? What stops people from changing the speed of their speech to where they can pick it up a little bit? And I figured it out. Slow talkers think while they're talking. It's like they are assembling the sentence right in front of you. And then when they finally finish, they're like, see what I made? You know, it's like an accomplishment. And what I always tell people, if you're a slow talker, if you want to pick up the pace, all you have to do is build the sentence privately instead of on company time. And then say it. And in this way, you can pick up the pace a little bit. Which brings me to voice volume. How many of you know people that can stand 3 inches away from you and shout at you? They're like, how you doing? You're like, I don't know, something broke, so now it's different already. Or people that mumble in loud environments. You ever had this happen? You know, if you fly a lot, you got to deal with very loud environments. And that person could have the information that's going to get you where you need to go. What if she's a mumbler? And it happens. She'll go, and I've watched people do this. They go, what? And the nice thing is they always repeat themselves. They go, what? And they're always nice enough to repeat them. And I'm thinking, what's the problem? You know what the problem is? You got to mumble back sometimes. I'm serious. You mumble back. Somebody goes, and this is what you do. You go, hey, buddy. I promise you, they're going to do this. They're going to go, what? Which is your cue to go, I know, I'm having trouble hearing you in here too. And they get it, and they start to speak up. Because that's blending. And by the way, when people are too loud, when you hear people that have very loud voices and seemingly inappropriate, they're probably hard of hearing. They probably actually need you to speak up to even hear what you're saying. So blending is the thing that you do naturally, automatically with people you love and care about or people you share a clear mission or objective with. But when those things aren't in place, it's very possible that that failure to blend is part of the foundation of the conflict between you, and people start making stuff up about those differences. Differences divide. Signals of similarity unite. And that's what blending is really all about. Now, that brings us to the 7% of communication, the words. And you know that 93% exists in service to the 7%. So even though it's only 7% of the meaning we make, it's the reason we're making the meaning. So the words are important. In fact, they're so important, it's important to remember that words are symbols for experience. The words we use represent something to us. That's how we choose them. But the interesting thing about it is what we tell each other represents only the surface structure of our thought. Most of the time when we talk, it's not that well thought out. We're not rehearsed. We just start talking. It's like we're skipping across the surface of our brain, accessing the immediate thing. That's the surface structure. But down below that tip of the iceberg is where all the good stuff lives. Values, motivation, needs, things that are important to us that inform those words, or at least in some point in time, inform the symbols that we've selected to use to express ourselves. And I say that when people talk to you, the fastest way to build a bridge between you as you're blending non-verbally and with the sound of their voice is to listen to go deep. Listen to do what? To go deep. You want to get to that deep structure information. Instead of defending yourself against what people say, you know, if somebody accuses you of something, try finding out what it means to them before deciding what you want to do about it. Somebody shared an example with me on the break of a boss who's really a bully. Well, guess what? I said, what happens? And she described it, and I wish I could remember the word that was used. I don't think it was imbecile. But that seeming bully says this thing, and I said, well, what happens after that? And the person says, no, that's not what I'm being, and defends himself. And what I'm saying is, listen to go deep. Find out what it means to them. You may be surprised, and so might they be. Because one of the things we know about people is most of the time, people don't even know what they're talking about. They haven't given it that much thought. It's just the surface of their thought. And by listening to go deep, things suddenly become more connected, more meaningful, and opportunities open up for building real relationship and resolving conflict. So I'm going to give you a very simple strategy to listen to go deep, and then we're going to play a quick game to test your ability to do it. Because there's a couple things I want you to learn that I can't quite tell you until you've experienced it. But this is the basic listening pattern. And by the way, it's not active listening. Anybody here ever learn how to do active listening? If you're like me, you hate it. I hate active listening. I took a class one time, and at the end of the class, I walked up to the guy that taught it. I said, you know, I sat through this whole thing, and I don't get what active listening is. And he said, well, for example, right now you're a bit frustrated with the course content. And I said, no, right now I'm trying to find out what active listening is. And he said, well, for example, right now you're a bit upset with me because of my response to your initial comment. And I said, no, but I think I'm getting a handle on the active listening thing. Let me see if I understand this. Whatever I say to you, you're going to tell me I said something else. How many of you like it when people do that to you? They say, what you're really trying to say, you idiot, you know. That's the subtext of what you're really trying to say because you're incapable of saying it. So let me say what you're really... you know what? If somebody tells me what I'm really trying to say, what I say to them is no. What I'm really trying to say is the thing I actually did say right before the thing you said that I did not say. Because when I use those words, I want them to be heard and understood. When you use your words, you want them to be heard and understood. You don't want people making up more stuff. You want them to go deep. When people talk, they want two things. They want to be heard and understood. What do they want? They want to be heard. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother to talk. So giving them the experience of being heard and understood gives them what they want, and they give you credit for that. Not only that, but when people talk, they like to hear themselves talk. Did you know that? I mean, you might know exactly where they're going and what they're trying to say, but letting them say it gives them the enjoyment of saying it, and you get credit for that. I said this to a group out in San Francisco. A woman put her hand up. She said, you know, I am from Finland, and in Finland, people do not like to hear themselves talk. I said, really? Tell me more about that. And she did. And in fact, after about 5 minutes, I said, you know, I want to get back to the program, but come talk to me on the break. I'm really interested in this. And she did. And it was a 15-minute break, and I ran out of time. I said, at the end of the day, I'd like to finish our conversation if you come back. And she did. And you know what? I'm convinced, even in Finland, people like to hear themselves talk. So I'm saying if you listen to people who want to be heard and understood and who like to hear themselves talk, you're giving them something of value to them, and you get the credit for it. So this is not active listening. This is listening to go deep, and it works like this. First, look like you completely understand. No matter what they say to you, and even if you have no idea what they're talking about, chances are you don't, look like you know exactly what they're trying to say to you. Everybody look at me while I'm presenting this like you completely understand. Even if you have no idea what I'm talking about, just notice what your body does when you try to do that. What happens? What's your head doing? You start nodding, and that's what you do. Any of you ever tried to tell somebody something and they started doing this? Does that help you? How about when they look at you like you're... Does that help you? No, you start throwing in other surface structure things trying to solve the problem that you don't even understand. I say, look like you understand exactly what they mean while knowing that you still don't know the deep structure behind it. That is the simplest way to do it. So while I'm doing this, keep nodding your head. It makes me feel good. Nonverbal attention, and then you want to sound like you completely understand. That means you grunt occasionally. Every once in a while you go, oh, uh-huh, yes, oh, uh-huh, ooh, no, I'm okay, mm-hmm, yeah. So you nod and you grunt. Everybody give me your best nodding and grunting while I'm talking about listening to go deep. There we go, beautiful, thank you very much. And you even talk like you completely understand. It's called backtracking. Backtracking is where you say back what they said to you. But not all of it, not with most people. With know-it-alls, there's an exception. We'll talk about that later. With most people, you just say back a few key words. In fact, if I said something to you and you didn't know what it was, but you recognized one word, just say back the word you recognize. If I tell you that when people get confused, they go on a transderivational search for meaning. What was the word? Did you hear something you recognize? Meaning. You go, oh, meaning. Search, oh. As if you completely understand. Now, you may be going, when do I get to look confused? Because it's very confusing. The answer is, the time to look confused is when you're asking questions. And the kind of question, that's Rick talked about it earlier, that's a congruent message. Where you go, huh? And you ask a question. That's completely a congruent message. So with you, and then you go, huh? And you ask a question. And open-ended questions require more than a grunt. They require information. Questions begin with what, who, where, when, and not why, but how. Now you may be going, why not why? Who wants to know why not why? Go ahead and ask me. Because. It turns out that why questions get you low-quality information when people don't know what they're talking about. So I say find out what, who, where, when, and how, then ask why, and suddenly you are in the deep structure. That's just the simple patterning of nouns, verbs, meaning. Get it? Good. All right. So open-ended questions. Always backtrack before asking a question. Now I'm going to throw in a couple more details, and then I'm going to turn you loose with a game. And the details go like this. First of all, what do you do if somebody's giving you too much information? You ever talk to somebody who is verbose? You ask a simple question and the answer goes on for days? Well, fastest way to go deep when somebody's giving you too much information, and this is a counterintuitive thing, is you say, tell me more. It's completely counterintuitive. You say, tell me more. You may be going, but I don't want them to tell me more. But you do, because how can you go deep if you can't backtrack, right? You got to backtrack, ask a question, backtrack, ask a question. So you say to the verbose person, oh, tell me more, they summarize. They already told you everything. So when you say, tell me more, they got nothing left, so they summarize. Now you can hear words, you can backtrack and go deep. One last thing. What if what they say to you is a complete non sequitur? It makes no sense at all. For example, you think you're talking about productivity, or you think you're talking about policy, and somebody goes, I'd be in Toledo, but I lost my underwear. This is the look that appears on people's faces in the presence of non sequiturs. They go, which in Oregon we call that trout mouth. But in communication, that's called going on a transderivational search for meaning. But whatever you call it, it's the look of confusion, and what's really going on is in the back of your brain, you're going, wait a minute, what does that have to do with this? Well, guess what? It's not your job to figure out what people mean by the confusing things they say. It's their job. They said it. They know what it means. You don't have to guess. You don't have to hallucinate freely. Ask them to tell you. And the way you do that, when you're confused, you simply ask the relevancy question, which is, what does that, and you say what the that is you thought we were talking about, have to do with this, and you say back the thing they just said to you. What does Toledo in your underwear have to do with a policy decision? And you know what? Maybe they have an answer. Maybe they're joking around. But no matter what, now we all know, and we can go forward. Make sense to you? Time and a place for everything. It's just not all the time in every place. Let me tell you where and when to listen in the way that I've just described. First of all, anytime you're dealing with an upset person, that is a great time to listen for deep structure information. I know you know this. You cannot reason with an upset person. But did you know you can get an upset person to become reasonable by listening? That's the whole benefit of it there. Secondly, when you think there's a hidden agenda, because let's say there is a hidden agenda. Well, if you tell people there's a hidden agenda, they're going to work harder to hide it from you. But if instead you look like, sound like, talk like, you completely hear and understand, and then you ask the question that reveals the hidden agenda, it surprises them and they reveal it by accident. Likewise, if you suspect it's a lie. If you think people are lying to you and you tell them they're lying, they're going to try harder to conceal the lie. But if you look like, sound like, talk like, you completely understand and ask the question that reveals the lie, it comes out before they can do anything about it. You want proof? Rent a Columbo video. That was the whole TV show, basically. Columbo would walk in, he would write it down like it was a fact. You know, where were you? I was in the boathouse. What time were you in the boathouse? Oh, 10 o'clock. And he would write it all down as if he completely heard, and then he'd go, just one question.
And by the end of every episode, they'd be like, man, just put me in jail. I can't take this anymore. So it's a great thing to do when you think it's a lie. And it's a great thing to do when what you're hearing strikes you as a bad idea, especially with teenagers. Because I know some of you have teenage children. And one of the things we know about teenagers is they do have bad ideas. And if you tell, it's a universalism. And if you tell children their ideas are bad, what are you requiring them to do? They're going to act on it. So if you don't want them acting on their bad ideas, look like, sound like, talk like, you completely understand, and then ask the question that reveals the badness of it, and they'll get the, how are you going to pay for that?
I don't know.
And now you're done. Our work is done. I'll say one more thing about this, that if you're too strong with it, if you ask questions too rapidly, it is like being an attorney in a court of law, or like being a police officer conducting an interrogation. So it's important to slow yourself down and get into the rhythm of the person you're talking to. That's blending. Lastly, it's a great thing to do anytime you're dealing with criticism. If you're like me, you don't like criticism, am I right? There's a part of you that has a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh yeah, let me explain it to you. But here's the thing. If you listen to people criticizing you in the way I just described, there's only three ways that could turn out. Way number one, you learn something you need to know about how they perceive you. Way number two, sometimes people are critical because of the mood they're in. And when you ask questions about their criticism, they call it off. They go, you know, it's not even, I'm, you know, sorry. And way number three, they know you hate criticism. That's why they do it to you. And when you put it back on them to make sense of their criticism, my desk is a mess in what way? They hate that. It's not fun that way, and they stop doing it. So those are five contexts where it's a great idea. And now, Rick, tell them about the next great idea.
All right, so something else related to the 55, 38, and 7. Anybody ever have a misunderstanding on email? Now, this is kind of an interesting thing, and that we've been writing to each other for hundreds of years, literally. I know we've been teaching communication for 30 years. We've never had so much conflict in writing until the digital age. So let's get conscious here. What's this all about? Well, in a written communication, you don't have the 55% how it looks. And you don't have the 38% how it sounds. It's basically a bunch of 7%, just some words. What that allows you to do is hallucinate freely as to how you think the other person sounds when they say it. And your hallucinations are going to be based on your stress level, your blood sugar curve, and everything you've got going on that moment. Now, anytime you lose channels of communication like that, you are losing a lot of valuable information. But as a successful communicator, you want to recognize that you're always given a gift back in return, something you would not have otherwise. Let's put aside writing for a moment. Let's get on the phone with people. Now, if we're on the phone and it's not a video call, we don't have the 55% how it looks, so it's all about the 38 and 7, how we sound and what we say. What you get in return for the loss of the 55% is so much more control over how you sound. Because how you sound is wired to your body. So if I was getting a little too intense in a conversation, if I put myself in a very relaxed posture, that will immediately translate through my tone. If, on the other hand, I need to become more assertive, I might want to stand up and move around. I remember once doing a seminar for Adobe for their tech support while it was still in this country. And one of the tech supporters said, when he's on the phone with a client, and the client's upset, and if he starts to take anything on personally, he gets out of his chair, still working with the client on a headset, and he starts doing yoga. Because he finds when he's in one of these postures, he just can't take anything personally. Now, if you're in a face-to-face interaction and suddenly you went, you give the other person trout mouth, even a mute button, you could hit a mute button on the phone and take a deep breath to compose yourself. If you breathe that obviously and dramatically, face-to-face, people have a reaction to it. With one call center I worked with, they had mirrors on people's desks that said smile, because if you change your facial expression in a smile, it automatically changes your tone. Your tone is wired to your body and especially intermittently wired to your facial expression. In fact, how humanoid life forms communicate emotion is through facial expression. A smile is recognize the same in every single culture on this planet. Crosses every language, every culture. And tone. Tone. In fact, that's probably one of the reasons we get along well with dogs. They always look like they're smiling. They're venting heat, but because they have the sweat glands, but they're smiling. So You totally can control your tone when you're on the phone. Now, coming back to written communication, what you're given in return is time is on your side. Time is your friend. So, what's the difference between the digital age and the old days? Well, let's go back to a time of yesteryear when the earth was still cooling and we had to write with a typewriter. How many people have written with a typewriter? All right. And you remember the drill. I don't think I have a piece of paper straight. Yes. Okay. No, no good. Okay. Get another piece of paper in there. Straighten it out. Good. You did two emails in this amount of time. Correct, 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 correct. Too many corrections. Rewrite. There was so much time in the process of writing that one of two things was going to happen. One, we might not bother. It was way too much work to write to people, so it was more likely we were going to go interactive, be it on the phone or face-to-face. Secondly, if we stayed in the process of writing, so much time passed, we would arrive at other points in our blood sugar curve. We would read. We would reread. We would edit. But in comes the digital age, and part of the seduction, it's quick and easy. And then, of course, we have a big volume to deal with, so we get in a real get-it-done mode. So we get something, we read quickly, we write quickly, we edit sparingly. Pew! Misunderstanding. So, repeat after me on three. I am hallucinating freely. One, two, three.
I am hallucinating.
You don't know how people sound! You are making it up! You may be right, you may be half right, but it's your fantasy. And here's a real irony in communication. Tone of voice is taken more personally than any other part of communication. We project the tone on the email, and then we take our own projection personally. So, you have to remember, you are making it up, no matter how real it sounds. And then the second thing you have to ask yourself is, email the best way to proceed? Just because this interaction began in this format does not mean it should continue. You want to set up some strict rules for yourself. Here's our advice to you, when to bail on email and go interactive. If you suspect emotional content, if you are having a strong emotional response based on what you're hallucinating about, if you think they're having a strong emotional response, treat that as a signal. It would be better to bail on email and go interactive. You probably get a lot more done faster. If you need to gather information and you have to ask more than X questions, X is one, yes or no. If it's any more complicated than that, you need to get interactive. Clarification requires back and forth. Right? I like fish. Well, okay, what do you mean by fish? Back and forth, back and forth. In a written situation, you could think you're on the same page, you're not even in the same book. And then, if you write something, and as you reread it, you have a little bit of concern about how they might take it, treat that as a signal that it would probably be better to go interactive. On the other hand, you know it's time to stay in writing if you need to complete a communication and you're not going to do it in person because maybe you're intimidated by this person or maybe they're very tanky and they're likely to interrupt you, talk over you, then it'd be better to write it all out. If you need to document information, here's the facts, here's the figures. All right, here's a summary of what I think we agreed to in our phone call. Would you say this accurately reflects that? That's documentation. And if you need to communicate the same thing to a number of people simultaneously. So let's go back to this point in time. We have an incoming. And we remind ourselves we are hallucinating freely. And we ask, is email the best way to proceed? And if our answer is now no, what we do is blend and lead to an interactive moment. So we might respond by going, I get this is very important to you. If they think it's important, acknowledging that will blend because you've written me. Now, anytime you simply say what is true, that is a blending statement. If I say to you, as you sit there, that's a blending statement because you're all sitting there. So just saying, because you've written to me, that's a blending statement. Now I lead. I think the best thing for us to do is talk about it. What's a good time for you? Now, if they come back with another round, just because they came back with another round does not obligate you to engage. Hold that line. Blend more. I get it's very important to you. Blend. I want you to know it's important to me. Blend. I know you've taken your valuable time. Blend. You've written me twice. Blend. We need to talk about it. Here's some times that are good for me. Pick whichever one is good for you. If they've CC'd everybody and their sister, then you probably have to do that to the whole CC list, but make sure there's one more step. When you do get together and you work it all out, send a summary to the CC list so you don't leave them hanging. If, on the other hand, we arrive at this point in time and we decide that writing is a good way to proceed, then realize time is your friend. Take time back on your side. So you're going to have to back away from that computer. Now, you may need to do what I call a brain dump and get all your thoughts out of your head so that you can go on to something else and focus on it. So I would recommend if you do this, make sure you do this in a separate text document. Do not do it in your email client. We've heard so many nightmare stories of people who, oh, they vented, they put it all out just to get it out in their email client, and when they went to hit save, they accidentally hit send. Do it in a separate text document. Just get it all out. Then, there's some things you definitely want to do. You ever reread an email the next day? Have you noticed that there are sentences in that email that were definitely not in that email the day before? You know why this is? Because email elves sneak in at night and add to the email. Why it is we as human beings can only pay attention to seven, give or take, two things at any one time. We read something, it triggers us in thought, we go off in thought, we read unconsciously. So one of the ways to avoid this is actually to read an email out loud. You will be less likely to space out if you read it out loud to yourself. Then, we want to consider that if we're writing to a humanoid life form, we're up against the same limitation, the limitation of their attention and their hallucinations. So order of concepts will be very important. If somebody, let's say, on our team that we're on suggests an idea, I think it's a really great idea because of this and this, but I have one consideration like this. If I start out with my consideration, I don't know because of this, but on the other hand, I think it's a great idea, we really should pursue it, you know what? They may never see those lines. Never at all. You always want to start positive and then go to the other aspects or considerations. Now, you usually have to do a second round because you're going to come up with your immediate response and that what you write. Then if you take a second pass on your email, that's when you could put in some pleasantries, acknowledge positives, and fix the order. Use more paragraph spacing than you would in any normal grammar. Because when people arrive at a white space in an email, they stop reading. They can be off in thought, but they come back to consciousness at the next paragraph. So breaking up paragraphs is a great idea. Anytime the thought changes in any way, make it a new paragraph in an email. Then, sometimes getting a second opinion can be really eye-opening, especially if you're having problems with people misunderstanding your emails. You know, I remember when I did a seminar for NASA, one of the astronauts said his commanding officer in the Air Force, who was very get-it-done, when he started using email, things got out of control because everybody was hallucinating tank attack. Now, he was not really attacking. He was just being direct and to the point, but suddenly everybody was free to think that. When he learned the perception that was created by his emails, he actually slowed his email process down whereby he would print out his email and show it to two people in his department, and not just anybody. Nice get-along people, they get along with everybody. What else would I add here to make sure there is no misunderstanding? You know, speaking of adding things, I've noticed like when if you write us with a question, you know, we want to give you a good response. And I know I found that the best way for me to do that is to dictate, to use dictation software into the computer. And what's funny about that is if I go blah 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 blah. Now, perceptually, I don't think I said very much. I cannot believe how much text that is on the page. There is no way I would have written that much with that detail. And then in rereading it, the difference between a pure communication that starts out in writing versus one that starts out in talking is very obvious. There's so much more detail. There are sentences that really set you up correctly of how to take the next sentence. There are paragraphs that give you the right framing of things. That's what's missing. Email has too many cracks in it that we can fall into. You can send it to yourself. That can be eye-opening. All of a sudden, you'll see the email completely differently. You'll see it from a receiver's perspective. Begin with intent. Now, there's some things we're covering in today's seminar that are really important in terms of eliminating conflict in your life. And it's conflict that is based on misunderstanding. And there's about five of them, and we've touched on a couple already. The first one we've touched on already is the mismatch between tone and words. You want to monitor your tone. Make sure your tone is going in the same direction with your words, and if it's not, realize that your words are canceled out, so you have to take responsibility for your tone. The second, Dr. Rick Kay touched on, is understanding. You want to let people feel understood first. Before you try to tell them anything, before you try to lead them, blend with them. Listen to them. Find out where they're really coming from. When people feel understood, the doors to their mind go, and they get wide open. The third one right here is intent. And if you think of communication like a phone number, then intent is your area code. It works best up front. It sets up a clear communication. You know, what I used to see a lot with couples is intent might be positive, but it won't get expressed and a misunderstanding occurs. Let's say somebody's upset about something, they want to clear the air. Good intent, right? So they go up to their partner, but they don't speak their intent. They just say, you know, I was upset the other day because... And before they get any further, their partner hears a sound in their mind like...
We are under attack. This is not a drill.
Misunderstanding. If you speak intent, you start out by saying, I love you, I care about you, I hate that something blocking our communication. I would like to clear the air. Ah, now they know where you're coming from. Home is not where you go when you're tired of being nice to people. Anytime you speak intent up front, you set up a clear communication. Now, there's a mental signal that lets you know it's time for intent. If you don't want somebody to take it the wrong way, that is a clear mental signal. It is time for a statement of intent. Well, we definitely don't want people to take our email the wrong way. So the first line of an email really should be a statement of intent. What do we want from this person in email? And then, if we are going to quote people or answer them, okay, now, way back in the early days of email, the way you quoted people, you had the caret sign, you know, the little V, and then you had the line, and it was going to be a different color, and then you wrote your response onto that line. Then the email clients evolved in copying the whole email, leaving it at the bottom, so we lazily just respond to the top. But you have to realize there's going to be a time delay between email. So somebody could have sent you something and said, I think it'd be a great idea, blah, 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 and then 24 hours later, you start an email with me too, I agree. What? What are you agreeing to? First of all, that person does not remember what. There's no bridge there, right? In a normal conversation, if I say, I think it'd be a great idea, blah, 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 then you can go, yeah, me too, because we're connected in time. But there's a disconnect in email. And a person has to go down to the bottom to figure out what they said. So really, make it easy for people. Take responsibility for that result. You know, you start out by saying, hi, blah, 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 my answer's below for clarity. And then quote them and put your answer right underneath. That'll save you a lot of time and save you a lot of time in misunderstanding. And then speaking of quoting, emoticons, okay? This is the wink, the smiley face. It's a good idea because it creates some context, but consider this. Normal quote marks, okay? Our little quote marks. So what does this tell us? Here we are reading happily along when all of a sudden we see these marks. Now we know all the words we're reading are coming out of the person's mouth exactly as is written until we see the marks again. What if the quote marks are only at the end of the sentence? Where's the quote? You don't know, right? Great. So we make a joke. We put a wink at the end of the sentence. When did you start joking? The reader doesn't know. They're already hallucinating freely based on their blood sugar curve. In fact, if you're only going to use one emoticon, at the beginning of where you start joking would be a better indication. All right, starting here, I'm kidding. If you really want to be clear, then break it out with white space, contain it with two winks. That's going to be a clear communication, and it's less likely people are going to misunderstand it. And then last but not least, before you send an email, I would suggest you read it out loud to yourself. And what you want to do is listen for tone dependency. If you find yourself suddenly changing your tone in any particular part of the email, that's not a good communication. And then this is the problem sometimes with joking in an email, because a lot of times a joke is the contrast between what you say and how you say it. But you can't depend on people hearing it in the tone in which you mean it. If anything is tone dependent in an email, it's an opportunity for confusion and for misunderstanding. So this completes our basic training. And what we're going to do for the rest of our day together is we're going to take a walk on the wild side around this lens of understanding. And we're going to clarify what the goal is and action steps for every one of these behaviors. For now, it's time to get on with the seminar. We're going to start with the tank first. Anybody got a problem with that? It's too bad. We're dealing with the tank first because they don't have all day. They got places to go. They got people to do. Now, tank behavior is going to originate out of our get it done area. It's all about the result. They are perceiving a situation as out of control, so they are declaring martial law. Once somebody goes into the tank mindset, everything is black and white. You're part of moving forward or you get eliminated. Anything that takes too long will escalate the attack. Anything they think is a tangent, a waste of time, or is going to escalate the attack, anything they perceive as forward motion is going to de-escalate the attack. Now, your overall goal when you face tank attack is command respect. Assertive people like assertive people. You will definitely blend with them by getting into the ballpark with them. Now, that doesn't mean that you mirror them, though, and become a tank back. Though, technically speaking, that is an option. If you think you can be a better tank than somebody, you say, make my day. But that may not be appropriate in all contexts or relationships. So, more often than not, we're going to breathe for a moment to compose ourselves, because if we're being personally attacked, our response will probably fall in one of two categories. Either we want to run and hide, or we want to wipe this bleep off the face of the earth. But we don't want either of those. We want to be assertive but not passive. We want to be assertive but not aggressive. And so we breathe for a moment to compose ourselves. And while they're attacking, assuming we're face-to-face, we remain 55% assertive. That means just freeze your position, look them in the eyes. Whatever position you were in when it started, you stop. If you're on the phone, you just... There's great power to this understatement. I learned it from a real good friend of mine who happens to be feline. They have four Siamese cats, Heidi, Chewy, Misty, and Pinky. Now, Heidi and Chewy are the first two we got. Same breeder, but different breeding. Heidi's long and sleek, only weighed 8 pounds, has super long tail, comes to a perfect point. She never just leaves her tail randomly behind her somewhere. She's always aware of the placement of her tail. If she sits like this, she wraps her tail around her. She sits like this, she curls her tail to her side. Hold her up in show cat position, perfectly straight spine, points her tail, puts up her head proudly, spreads out her arms. She's not stuck up at all, she's just been to cat finishing school. Chewy, on the other hand, you hold him up in show cat position, his stomach hangs down. Heidi clearly understands concept. We only have to explain it once. It's nothing personal, but we don't really want to have cats on the kitchen counter. Her response was, I haven't seen you go up there, so therefore why would I? And she'll always sit very dignified, waiting for dinner, tail wrapped around her. Chewy, on the other hand, either doesn't get it or doesn't care. Because he wants to know, hey, what's for dinner? Well, Chewy, you got to get down. Oh, no, I want to know what's up here. Years later, we got a third cat, Misty, to breed. She's accepted by the other two. But when she had her kitten, she got a little strange, especially with Heidi. One day, we're all in the kitchen. I'm preparing something for him. Chewy jumps up. I put him back down. Chewy jumps up. I put him back down. Heidi is there, very dignified, waiting for dinner, tail wrapped around her. Misty, who outweighs Heidi by 2 pounds, comes into the room, walks up to Heidi. Smacks her right between the eyes. Heidi's response to that was, she didn't shirk away at all. She didn't twitch. She just blinked. She got hit in the eyes and simply looked. And Misty's response to that was, I don't know what came over me. These five kittens are driving me crazy. Listen, I'm lactating. I'm really not myself. It only took once. Misty got it. I got it. Even Chewy got it. Yeah. Chewy sat up there on the counter watching him interact. Yeah. And when they were done, he looked at me and said, if she told me to get off the counter, I'd stay off. Great power of the understatement. However, here's the key factor. You never want to let somebody in a tank mode vent for too long. Yes, it is good to let them vent a little bit, but too long will actually backfire. In fact, if you were to graph a tank's emotional response, all right, here we've got emotions. And here we've got time. So they start way up here. They vent. They get some of that out of their system. But if they don't see any forward motion, they come shooting right back up again. And then up again. And then up again. And it keeps accelerating. So the trick with a tank is you let them vent a little bit, and then you interrupt them at the bottom of the first curve. Now, how do you know you're at the bottom? There's a judgment call to make, but I'll give you an important clue. The time from here to here is measured in seconds. It's usually 60 seconds or less venting time when people are in a tank mode. Now, the best way to interrupt somebody is say their name a few times quickly. Whatever name is appropriate between the two of you. Do not comment on the marital status of their parents or their mother's canine gender. Sir, 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 Frank, 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 Mr. Binder, Mr. Binder. A name is one of the first sounds that we recognize. Oh, it's me. So that gets people's attention. And then you immediately backtrack. I hear you think we're genetic mistakes and we're way behind. Do not defend yourself. I'm not a genetic mistake. My mother had amniocentesis, so I will bring in my records on Monday. If you defend, they will offend. Now, take note, you're not interrupting in the sense that you're taking the conversation off in a different direction. You're just butting in and blending by acknowledging I'm listening to you. Two sentence, greatest hits, backtrack. The tank will go back to venting. You pay your way behind, you're also costing us. Sir, 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 I hear this is costing us. Interrupt again, backtrack again, blend. I'm listening. Now, how long should you hang out at this point? My advice to you is three rounds. Interrupt, backtrack one, interrupt, backtrack two, interrupt, backtrack three. There's two reasons for this. First of all, it's something in human behavior called the generalization point. So, for example, if we're driving someplace and we stop for two or three red lights in a row, how many lights do we say are red today? All of them. We meet two or three people in a bad mood. How many people in a bad mood? Everybody, right? This is the generalization point. And as soon as we form that little generalization, our brainstem, our reticular activating system goes doot, 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 and it starts tracking that which fits our generalization. So, interrupt, backtrack number one, I'm listening. Interrupt, backtrack two, I'm listening. Interrupt, backtrack three, I'm listening. That's more than enough for a generalization point. On a subconscious level, the tank is going to get that you're listening. However, backtracking, the other reason you don't want to dwell too long right there is because backtracking is not really forward motion. For the tank, everything's about forward motion and results. So though it is good that we're letting them know we're hearing them, if we linger too long, it's going to backfire. It's exactly the same as venting. Yes, we definitely need to let them vent a little bit, but you can't let it go on too long or they escalate. We definitely want to let them know we're listening, but we can't linger too long there either, or it escalates. So what we do is we go interrupt, backtrack, one, two, three, and then we come right out of the backtrack to the bottom line. To the bottom line. Now, what you actually say at this point really depends on what's the situation. What are we talking about here? The best bottom line to try to establish is you and they are actually on the same side. So if you said to somebody, we both want what's best on this project, when you say that, you're taking both of you, putting on you both on the same side, wanting what's best on this project. If somebody has a problem they're upset about, and you said to them, I'm here to help you, we're going to do something about this, they've got a problem, they want help, you're here to help, same side. And what you just did is you spoke intent. And intent, as we mentioned earlier, is the area code of the phone number. It puts you in the right general vicinity. And you always know it's time for intent if you're worried about people taking things the wrong way. So we try to make a statement of intent. Now, in some cases, maybe we're not on the same side. So, for example, let's say you and I are in a conversation. In the middle of our conversation, somebody starts attacking. We might say, Mary, 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 I hear you saying blah, 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 blah. Backtrack. I'm in the middle of a conversation right now, and I'm not willing to discuss this if this is how you're going to talk to me. Or let's say the context is a meeting, and we're not really supposed to interrupt each other. In the middle of my presentation, I get attacked. Frank, 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 I hear you saying blah, blah, blah. It's my turn to speak right now. And then we lead. Now, where you lead depends on what the circumstances are, but how you lead depends on what just occurred. Did we establish common intent or not? Let's go back to being on the same side with somebody. Let's say we've got a person who has a problem. And we say to them, I'm here to help you. Great, common intent. We're going to do something about this. Now, we're going to do something about this. It's a take charge attitude. Take charge blends delightfully with a tank. Because the tank is perceiving situation out of control. So somebody's going to really take charge of the situation. We'll blend with them. But now imagine you're the tank. You question whether, you know, I've got the what it takes to move things forward. And I say to you, well, we'll try to do something about that. Got confidence in that? Let's get rid of the word try. Well, we'll do something about that. We're going to do something about that. You do have to up your energy level. That also blends with them. Take charge. Now, let's say, staying with this scenario, we got somebody who has a problem. The next thing that really needs to happen is I've got to ask them a few questions to get the details of the problem. If I'm really going to help them solve the problem, I need to know a little more about it. Be careful. Never just start asking questions of somebody who's already in a tank mindset. It's more than likely they'll perceive your questions as a waste of time, an irrelevant tangent. Here's what needs to happen. So, communicators, whenever you don't want people to take things the wrong way, that means it's time for positive intent. In order to solve your problem fast, I need to ask some questions. Oh, now they know the intent behind asking questions is to get their problem solved fast. And what we would do here is add a short time frame. It'll only take a minute. Somebody in a tank mode doesn't have all day for a long question and answer session. You definitely have to set them up if you're going to ask them questions and have a nice short time frame. And that time frame better be accurate, because you wouldn't want to figuratively say it'll only take a minute and then start asking questions for 5 minutes. Because the tank's going to be, you know what, you said it's a minute, it's 5 minutes, boom! So you'd be accurate. It'll only take 5 minutes, it'll only take 15 minutes, it'll only take 2.5 days. You say it'll only to diminish it, but you be accurate, and now they're ready to be led, and the way you would lead that tank is with a question, do you mind? And the only reason, and even as you lead, you blend, because when you say, do you mind, you're basically turning it over to them. They get to decide what happens next, so they're still in control. But the only reason you turn it over to them is you know what's going to happen next. They're going to go in the direction you want them to go. Let's take a running start at this. Blah, 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 blah. All right. Interrupt, backtrack one, I'm listening. Interrupt, backtrack two, I'm listening, blend. Interrupt, backtrack three, I'm listening, blend. I'm here to help you. Intent, blend. We're going to do something about this. Take charge, attitude, blend. In order to solve your problem fast, intent, blend. I need to ask you a few questions. It'll only take a minute. Short time frame, blend. Do you mind? And we've popped out the other side. It may only take 100 seconds, actually, to go from one end of the strategy to the other. But it's a very precise 100 seconds. You will see with some of our other slides, there are no numbers on it because there is no sequence. It's just a bunch of things you do when people act that way. The tank is a little bit more complex because not only is there a sequence of order, but timing is also critical. Number one, yeah, we want to let them vent, but not too long. Number three, yeah, we got to show them we're listening, but we can't dwell there for too long. So sequence and timing is critical. But your reward is you can get somebody out of the tank mode faster than you can probably any other behavior. That's the reward. Now, coming back to not being on the same side, all right? Mary interrupted our conversation. Frank attacked at the meeting. We're not going to say to them, would you mind if I continue? They're not going to let us. And so in that case, we're going to lead with an assumption. If I say to you, will you pay cash or will you pay credit? What am I assuming? That you're going to pay for something. If I say, when you get back from lunch, what am I assuming? That you're coming back. So if I say, Mary, when you're ready to speak to me with respect, what am I assuming? At some point, she'll be ready to do that. If I say, Frank, when I'm through with my presentation, I'm assuming I'm going to get through it. That's how you lead if you did not establish common intent. But in those cases, there's one more step, and that is peace with honor, which means let them know they'll have another word. Mary, when you're ready to speak to me with respect, I'll take all the time you want to discuss this with you. Frank, when I'm through with my presentation, it's time for feedback. I am totally open to hearing your criticism. We throw the door wide open for them. For somebody in the tank mode to temporarily back off is not that big a deal to them because they're not all caught up in their ego at that moment. Tank is not really an ego-motivated behavior. It's all about results. That's why they're so ruthless with people, because they're not concerned about people's feelings or what people think of them. It's all about the result. And this is also why they can come up to you afterwards and go, hey, I didn't know you had it in you. Yeah, you didn't know I had this in me, either, did you? This is the proverbial high school bully you stand up to and then becomes a best friend. Assertive people like assertive people. Any stupid questions? No question stupid, but staying in character. But ask him if you got him. We don't have all day here. What?
As I'm sure most of you do, I have parents that call and scream at me. And I find it difficult to call them on that behavior, where I would actually say, you know, you're... you're screaming at me, and, you know, that's when often what I'll do is say, you know, I can see that you're really upset, and when you're ready to talk about this again, feel free to call me back. But to actually call somebody on their behavior right at that moment, I find that a difficult thing to do. I did do it once recently where the mom was saying, you never help me, you never help me, you never help me. And finally I said, you know, that's not fair to say that about me. And she stopped then. So I'm guessing that your ideas work, but that's a very uncomfortable feeling for me to do that.
Well, I'm not suggesting actually in the strategy, we're not calling that person on their behavior because we're not giving any judgment about the behavior or telling them it's inappropriate, except in the example of what we're not on the same side. Mary interrupted me. I'm in the middle of conversation, but I'm willing to, but wait, leave the door open. So we're not really dealing with the behavior. We're dealing with the behavior in the sense of getting it to wind down and getting it to a more rational track so that we can have a conversation. Now, in the example you said, I think it would be a great thing to make a statement of intent. You know, excuse me for interrupting, I'm sorry, but I just want to tell you, I think it's great how much you care about your child. There's so many parents who wouldn't even bother, and for you to call and rip me a new one, I mean, it really shows a lot of love on your part. And though it hurts, I really appreciate that. Now, again, anytime humor, okay, anytime you do humor, that really disarms people. But I would throw that monkey wrench in the works right from the... If it's a repeat behavior, then you can prepare for it.
Yep.
Yep.
I think my general confrontation kind of applies, too.
I think so, too. You know, I remember I was in a seminar, and on a break, the executive assistant to the president pulls me over, and she said that the last company she was with was taken over in a hostile takeover by one of these organizations that purposely buys the organization and chops it up, sells off the pieces, lays everyone off. So half the organization is getting laid off right away. She was hoping to be part of that group because you got a good severance package, but she wasn't. And to make matters worse, the new president, who was a famous ruthless hatchet man, made her his executive assistant. So she devised an evil plan. She was going to get laid off. So when he would make a decision, she would just tell him what she thought of his decisions. Want him or her to do something, she would talk back to him. Always back in his face. Never got laid off. Finally, a year later, when the company was completely folding up the tent, she came right out and said to him, listen, I don't understand. I've been talking back to you. I challenge you. I've been in your face. I'm trying to get laid off for the last year. How come you never fired me? He goes, are you kidding? You're the last person I would have laid off. That's how I knew what was going on around here. In fact, I was going to ask you, would you come to my next job with me? Assertive people like assertive people. That they appreciate that. At least, now, keep in mind, it doesn't mean somebody can never go in another mode. They can be in a real get-along mode. I remember when we first worked for a public seminar company, and this president was known as the most ultimate poster boy of the tank, ruthless, whatever. We established a little rapport with him, and he invited us over his house on Sunday to watch football. And the biggest shock was when we got there, he had a little toy poodle. Hey, Tiger. Yeah. Tiger, would you look a good boy? Yeah, you said you're a good boy, Tiger. Look at the rinks. Yeah, look at the rinks. Unbelievable. Juxtaposition of the image that everybody had in his company and what little experience we also had him. Different context, different relationships, different behaviors. So you definitely want to mentally rehearse for the tank. And in fact, mental rehearsal is the way you're going to change a lot of your reactions because... You know how you hear a song and it takes you back, or you smell something, or transport it through time? Now, you didn't do that on purpose. Your mind just did it for you. But you know enough to use it on purpose. Let's say I'm about to leave the house. I want to grab something to eat. I'm at the refrigerator. I remember my cell phone in the bedroom. So I go to the bedroom to get my... What I come over here for? But I get dropped by aliens in the bedroom? But you know what to do. Cell phone! That's right. Minds will be minds, and the moment you touch that handle and think about the phone, a link is made between the two. The link is not permanent yet. What really makes a link stick is repetition, like the song that plays over and over and over, or intensity. If you get sick on a certain food, it's a while before you want to eat that food. And so this is what your mind is always doing, but you can use your mind on purpose. See, You know how it is when you have an uncomfortable interaction with somebody? You think of it over and over. Oh, they said that, I felt bad. They said that, I felt bad. Said that, I felt bad. Said that, I felt bad. Think about what's going on. You're doing repetitions to the way it was. And so, therefore, the next time you see them, you feel bad even more quickly because you've been practicing in your spare time. Yeah. Minds will be minds. Now, the good news is you got plenty of mental time. And what you want to do is mentally rehearse how you want to be. What reaction do you want? And one of the things you can do is identify, what do I want myself? And who would have it? For example, when I was learning to speak in front of groups, I was nervous. I wanted to be calm and centered. I thought, who'd be calm and centered in front of 200 people? And I thought of Kwai Chang Kane from the Kung Fu television show. If any of you don't remember, he's a Kung Fu master in the old Wild West. I think they were the first to throw people in slow motion. And he was not going to worry about 200 people. He could take them. They rushed the stage. And it was amazing. All I'd do is think Kwai Chang, and I would feel calm and centered. Without realizing what I was doing as a technique, I was still living in New York City. I wanted to be more loving and forgiving. I thought, who would be more loving and forgiving? I saw God. I thought, there's a model of love and forgiveness. I started to pretend to be God in New York. And it worked. And as a great side effect, suddenly I was no longer bothered by red lights or traffic. I was at an intersection, light turned green, out I go. One of these big old checker cabs runs a light, bam, it's my car, spins me around. Thank God I'm okay. My car's demolished. The cab only has a scratch. I'm trying to pretend to be God. I got out of my car, he got out of his car, he looked at me, I looked at him, and I said unto him, go forth and multiply. They're not quite those words. I don't know if they ever got that joke in Hong Kong, honestly. Taking a while here in Akron. Some of you will have a laugh on the break when people explain it to you. All right, but here it is. You have a God-given gift. It is called modeling. There are things your parents said or did you vowed you would never say or do, and then you say then do them, and that's because the child's world of pretend is not just fooling around. They're trying on behavior like clothing. Animals do this too. Geese are not raised by their parents, do not know to go south for the winter. A lot of carnivores not raised by their parents. They don't know how to hunt. So this is the way you take on new behavior. It's free software, and what you want to do is mentally prepare yourself, and if you don't feel like you have it in you, then you think, who would have it in you? In me. You know, I had a patient who wanted to be more assertive. I said, who do you think could do that? She goes, Katherine Hepburn. She'd show him. And I imagine being Katherine Hepburn interacting took care of the situation. Modeling is free software. It comes with your hardware.
You know, something Rick was talking about reminds me of an experience that I had flying to Hong Kong for the very first time. Where's that thing? There it is. I'm about to tell you about a little trick of the mind that leverages what he's been describing called the gentle confrontation. I got hired by the Hong Kong Telephone Company in 1991. Very long trip. I think from the West Coast it was about 26 hours to get there. And, you know, you lose a day going and then they try to give it back to you, but it's stale at that point. You don't want it. And I'm sitting next to a guy from New York City who's got that classic New York accent. You know, this and that and those and yous and them. He's even got that laugh, like, hey, it's a good one. And all he wanted to talk about was everything that ever went wrong in aeronautical history since Orville and Wilbur first took off from Kitty Hawk. And he knew. I mean, he knew the latitude and longitude where every plane went down, how many people were wounded, where they buried the survivors. And this is what he wanted to talk about on this incredibly long flight. Now, I tried ignoring him. 3 hours into the flight, I acknowledged his existence for the very first time when I looked at him and I said, you know, I really don't like hearing this kind of stuff when I'm flying over high, rocky places in deep water. And he goes, too bad. He says, I'm doing you a favor. And someday, maybe even, you'll thank me if you live. Hey, it's a good one. Come on. Goes, So I put in earplugs. I thought he'd take the hint. The hint he took was to talk louder. Now I have people all over the plane glaring at me for failing to contain this. Finally, the plane lands in Hong Kong, and it's one of those days when it lands on one wheel instead of two, which happens more often than most people realize. Like in 1972, well, I'm not going to bother you with it, but anyway. And he taps me on the shoulder, and I'm pretty uptight at this point from all this input, and he taps me on the shoulder. I go, what? He goes, your chances of dying in a plane crash are, and he gives me a number that ends with 283, and I was doing 140 programs a year. So that meant flying in and out of the Medford airport plus the trip to wherever I was going. The numbers weren't looking good. And then the plane settled down. Before I could breathe a sigh of relief, he taps me again. I go, what? He goes, for you now. And he gives me the same number minus one. Make a long story short, I think life has a funny way of balancing accounts. And what I'm saying is this is the only guy who's, he's the only guy whose bag didn't make it to Hong Kong. That's what I'm saying. So, and I knew this would be a great story. And I followed this guy from a discreet distance as he finds a baggage clerk whose only crime is showing up for work. And this guy is in his face screaming and hollering and shouting and raving about how important he is and he doesn't need this kind of treatment. It's a waste of it. And this baggage clerk did what I called a gentle confrontation, and this is what I saw him do. Remember my friend Max nodding his head? Well, this guy did the same thing, but only for about 45 seconds. He didn't wait for the guy to run out. He just did it just long enough to kind of blend with him. He's like that. And then he began to interrupt him using what I like to call the tactful interruption. This is what you do when people won't let you get a word in edgewise, and you've given them their turn. Listen to go deep. Now it's your turn, and they keep cutting you off. You say their name or gender over and over in a calm, steady tone of voice. Sir, 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 ma'am, 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 ma'am. If you know their name, just Mary, 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 Joe, Joe, Joe. And this is not the time to make up a new name for them. But you say it over and over in a calm, steady tone of voice until they say the magic word, which is what? And so he's standing there, he's going, sir, 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 sir. And the guy goes, don't you interrupt me. He goes, sir, sir, sir. And finally the guy goes, what? And this is what I witnessed. He said, you know, there are only two people standing here that could care very much about the future of your baggage. And he let that sink in, and then he goes, and one of them is rapidly losing interest. That's a gentle confrontation. You feel the power of that? I mean, you know, what we just described, what Rick just described to you about dealing with a tank, it's very strategic, and it really implies a certain contextual relationship. But how many of you deal with members of the public, for example, where you don't have a long track record with people, you have this moment with them? Just curious. So, you know, in those situations where you don't have the track record, you don't have all this information to draw on, you have to be able to respond with something. And more often than not, it's a matter of blending with something and then disrupting the pattern in some useful way. I remember one time I stopped at a convenience store for a cup of coffee. My mom brought me up to be nice to people for no good reason. And so when I walked into this convenience store, I said, good morning, the guy behind the counter. I said, good morning. He was not raised by my mother. And he was like, so I was like, no problem. Where's the coffee? And he said, it's over there. And I thought, well, at least he knows where it is. So I went over to where the coffee was. I poured it into a cup, and I looked around for a little milk or cream or half and half to put into the coffee, and all they had was non-dairy creamer. I don't know how you feel about non-dairy creamer. I do not accept petroleum as one of the five basic food groups. So I'm looking around for something to put in the coffee from a cow. They don't seem to have anything. I walk up to the guy, this very unfriendly guy, say, excuse me, do you have any milk, cream, or half and half, something from a cow? And the guy goes, no. I appreciated this certainty. I said, you know, I hate non-dairy creamer, don't you? I was trying to find something in common. The guy goes, I like it. Well, this is kind of a tank behavior, you know. He's very controlling the situation. He's not being helpful to me in any way. And that's when I realized what the real problem was. You know, I looked around and I thought, you know, if I can't get what I want, milk, creamer, half and half, I wonder if there's something else. I try to be resourceful. I saw a cooler with 14 flavors of ice cream and I thought, you know what? A spoonful of ice cream would solve my problem perfectly. So here I am in this situation, seemingly hostile situation, and I have a direction. So now I go to the guy and I say, since you won't give me any milk creamer half and half, and all you have is non-dairy creamer, which I don't like, could I get a spoonful of ice cream in my coffee? And the guy goes, no. I said, I'm willing to compromise. How about a half a spoonful of ice cream? And the guy goes, I said no. And that's when I realized what the problem was. Here I was being friendly and helpful and trying to meet this guy in a pleasant way, the way my mom brought me up to be with him. I was being nice to somebody that wasn't being nice. And I realized I'm not blending with this guy. I'm completely ignoring the signals that I'm getting and focused on my own agenda. And that's when I set down the cup of coffee. Why? He wasn't holding one. In that one moment, I reduced the difference between us. I then folded my arms like him, put my left foot in front of my right foot like him. I even made my face look a little like his, which was no easy task. In a voice a little less aggressive than him, but definitely strong enough for him to know I was there, I said, look, is this something I did, or are you just having a rough day? And I swear to you, he goes, the night shift leaves me the mess. I got to clean it up. What flavor? That's a true story. Just like that. So I told him,
chocolate chip. Now, that's where... But that's where meeting people where they are, finding a way to raise your energy level a little bit, to meet people where they are, can make all the difference in the world. Blending is the starting point for being able to have a meaningful interaction with people. All those things Rick just told you about that were very strategic, they're forms of blending, of meeting people where they are, and it makes all the difference in the world.
Next slide.
Next slide.
Let's see if we can lower our IQ so we can have a meaningful dialogue with these people.
Yeah, it's very funny.
Oh, don't get all emotional. Can't you take a joke? Sniper! Two people in one. We have friendly sniping. We have malicious sniping. We have friendly gossip, fun to do, not trying to hurt anybody, malicious gossip, purposely spread. The bottom line with all sniping is a sniper can't snipe. There's no place to hide. Let's talk about the friendly stuff first. Now, friendly stuff originates out of appreciation. It's about making connection, put down humor, gossip. However, the problem with friendly sniping is it can have unwanted consequences. For example, about 2 years ago, I got called into two organizations where, well, here's one. It was a Federal Reserve Bank branch, and it's the IT department, and they're creating a new system. So they divided the IT department into the people who are creating the new system and the legacy people who are maintaining the old system. It kind of ended up divided by seniority. The people who were there longer were maintaining the old system, and the younger people were doing the new system. They started making jokes with each other, the young whippersnappers, oh, the old fogies. And it was all kidding around at first, but the manager brought me in and said he watched as it got darker and darker, and about 2 months later, they actually were at war with each other. Same thing happened for a group that manages health insurance for major organizations. So one group manages the health insurance for UPS. They're nicknamed the Dark Side. You're going to Brown, the Dark Side. And as they established nicknames for each other, the two groups, all of a sudden, again, it took about 2 months, became dark. Someone in a seminar told me that she was in a new job, new team of people, and they were looking at a project, who's going to do what, and she made a joke, well, don't give me that part. That's got numbers. I can't even balance my checkbook. Everybody laughed, and then they start teasing her. Well, we'll give that to Susie. She can't balance her checkbook. And this went on and on for months. Well, unfortunately, that concept that she was not good with numbers leaked out beyond the immediate group who understood the original joke, and it hurt her ability to be promoted. So though it on the surface there's good intent, you have to be careful. Now, I know as a New Yorker, as a born and bred New Yorker, that's where sniping is at its pinnacle. And the way you show somebody else affection, you say, well, you remember we were at a training in California, communication training. And Todd, the trainer, and us, we got a good rapport going. And Todd and I were able to do this whole New York thing since he was from New York, too. And finally, at the end of the training, he says, all right, you guys, here, I'm going to give you my home number. If you're ever up there in Oregon and you're stuck with a patient, you feel free to call me, and I'll help you out. But so help me, you better not give this number. I never give my home number to anybody. You better not give this to anybody else, because if somebody, if you do, I'm going to hunt you down, break you off your legs, beat your head up till it's a bloody pulp, and throw away the limbs. So we walk away, and I look at Rick, and he doesn't look well. And I say, you okay? He goes, no, I'm not okay. What if somebody calls Todd? He thinks we gave him the number. He's going to hunt us down. I said, what, are you stupid? That means he likes us. And this initiated a conversation between us that I did found out that he did not have quite the level of affection and appreciation of friendly sniping that I did. Even though we were doing it back and forth, he was laughing on the outside, but sometimes bleeding on the inside. And I did find as I went out west, people can't keep up. So I have reformed. However, it's still there. I got a phone call about a year ago. I pick up the phone. I go, hello? And the person on the other end goes, hey, loser! And I go, oh, yeah, you loser. Now, you know you can think about a million things in 1 second at a time? I'm thinking, I'm not sure who this is. But I really like him. He must be a really good friend of mine. And we're going back and forth, ripping each other apart. And I'm thinking, any moment now, I'm going to know, any moment. And it's like the inside of my brain's like Terminator. I'm scanning lists of friends. No, New Yorkers. No. And finally, it's like a minute and a half has gone by, and I'm getting further and further lost. And finally, I said, look, I am really sorry. Who is this? And he says, oh, no, I'm sorry, wrong number. He hung up. I don't want him to hang up. I want to go to lunch with him. So, I mean, you want to be careful. The intent is initially good, but it can have unwanted consequences. So here's what you do. You want to harness their good intentions. So maybe you go out to lunch with this person one time, and, you know, then at one point you say, listen, I have to tell you, I really appreciate our relationship, and I love humor, but I have to be honest with you, I don't feel comfortable with put-down humor. I don't feel good being the butt end of your jokes. And they'll go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. It's just, you make such a good butt. Oh, that's what you're talking about. All right, I'll be good. And then you're going to get about, guaranteed, you're going to get about 2 weeks of behavioral change. Your next step is catch them in the act of doing it right. When they make a joke that's not a put-down, you say, thank you. What? Thanks for not using put-down humor. Oh, sure, no problem. See, the friendly stuff is all motivated out of attention and appreciation. So if you give attention and appreciation to the new behavior, they turn to that like leaves turn to the sun. They may never understand why you don't appreciate the affection of a little put-down humor or the fun of gossip, but they'll get retrained around you because they like you. That's what you have to harness. Now, malicious sniping, that's a different story.
Thank you very much. That's funny. I was just thinking of two things you were talking about. Remember when Rick was talking about the refrigerator handle and the associations you make and how that's your software and you can use it? You know all kinds of people that can deal with all kinds of problems, and being able to put yourself in their shoes might solve some of your problems with people. It is a great idea. I remember one time my friend, we're talking sniping, One time, my friend Florence Minshall, that ran the Minshall Theater in the tiny town of Talent, 10 miles north of Ashland, asked me if I would emcee the melodrama. I had been Ebenezer Scrooge. My daughter had been Tiny Tim in a Christmas musical, and so she just somehow thought I could do this. And by the way, that was typecasting. She said, would you come in and emcee the melodrama? And I'm like, I've never done it. What's involved? And she told me, and the way she described it, it sounded so easy, even I could do it. Not unlike the kind of stuff we're saying to you today. We're making it sound so easy. And I know a lot of you are sitting there going, well, I don't know how easy that is. I know for sure you're having that thought. She says, all you got to do is come down, teach them to hooray the hero and boo the villain and make a joke and introduce the scene. You do that 22 times and you're out of there. I was like, I could do that. What she didn't prepare me for were the 20 obnoxious drunks that were in the audience that night, and that they were all in a group, and that the ringleader was the father of the heroine in the melodrama. And that means he knew things and they knew things about her that she would have preferred not to be revealed in an audience of 200 people, like her nickname from childhood. And anybody have a nickname from childhood you hope nobody ever finds out about? Quick show of hands. What was it? I'm just curious. The look on her face. So can you imagine 20 drunks in an audience yelling that at you on stage? The play starts falling apart. People start losing their place, their lines. Everybody feels so bad for her. She feels bad for them. The whole thing's falling apart. And meanwhile, this is such bad behavior. And this was back in the early days. This was back in the early 1980s when I still was very thin-skinned. I walked out there. I didn't really know what to do, so I made something up. I walked out on the stage. I stopped the play. I said, you know what? We're going to stop it right here for a moment. And I pointed at the people. I said, what are you doing? It's really inappropriate. It's rude. And when you hear people laughing, it's because they're uncomfortable. They're like, let's keep going. I said, it's okay to hooray the hero and it's okay to boo the villain, but the rest of this, please stop. These guys worked for 2 months to build this show for a night of family entertainment. Let's do this right. So basically, I made an appeal for decency. And I know a lot of you, that makes sense to you, doesn't it? I learned a lesson that night. I learned that when you position yourself between a sniper and the target, you become the target. Because sure enough, from that point on, they left everybody else alone and waited for me. And every time I walked out there, they'd start yelling the most horrendous stuff, and it was offensive to me. And by two-thirds of the way through the play, I didn't want to go out there anymore. I mean, they had to shove me out behind to get out there. You got to keep it going. And I'll never forget, because it was a very embarrassing moment for me. I walked out on that stage, and I was fit to be tied. I didn't know if I wanted to scream or laugh maniacally. I really did not. And this is what I said to the audience. Kid you not, I said, you know, I don't need this kind of abuse because I'm a professional. And then I walked off the stage and I got in my pickup truck and I drove home. And in my mind, I started playing it. How many of you ever played something bad over and over the privacy of your own mind to make sure you didn't miss out on the badness of it? You ever had one of those?
So by the time I got home, this was a Spielberg effect with the spinning newspaper. You know, Kirshner leaves the stage. I live in a small town. In my mind, everybody's going to be talking about this the next day, and I'm wondering, what did I even mean by that thing I said? I'm a professional what? Quitter. That's the only thing I can think of. Anyway, I had a rule in my life not to take stuff that happened outside the house and dump it on my family, and my family knew this about me, so sometimes they'd sit out in the driveway until I had a breakthrough. And, you know, back in the day when my daughter's a little girl, she might come out for a kiss goodnight, my wife might bring me something to eat, you know, have a breakthrough yet? No! A breakthrough is when you can answer the question, what else could I have done? But that's the first step, not the whole step. And I'm sitting out there going, I can't think of a thing. So the next question is, well, who do I know that would have known what to do? And I thought of my little brother, Gary, the one who just turned 60 in Cincinnati. Because when we were growing up, Gary had a knack for saying things that really ticked people off, which he enjoyed. In fact, if people started to calm down with him, he'd throw gas on the fire. He goes, sounds like a personal problem. And people would really lose it with him. And I thought he was defective. I tried to fix him. I failed. He's still like this to this very day. And I thought if Gary would have been on that stage with those drunks, he would have had the time of his life. I thought, what does Gary know that I don't know? And the answer is he knows all these rotten things to say back. Funny, rotten things to say back. I'd never learned any of them. Gary had mastered an encyclopedia of them. Mm-hmm. Now I had two choices. Ask my brother for help. That wasn't going to happen. And the other was to go to a library and to get a book. And I did. It was called Galaxy of Quips, Quotes, and Puns, and I memorized 20 rotten things that are funny that you can say back. Rick's already used one of them in today's program. It's that good. I'll probably repeat it. I called Florence. I said, can I MC the melodrama? Now, I want you to hear something that I did because it's something you can do. I put myself back on that stage in the privacy of my mind, facing that same audience with those same drunks, that same painful experience, only this time I had this book. So I could look in the book, get a line, go back into this mental fantasy and practice saying it, get another one, practice saying it, until pretty soon I didn't need the book anymore. I needed an opportunity. Here's how you know when you're ready to deal with people that have been difficult for you to deal with in the past. You'll want to. You won't be like, uh-oh. You'll be like, bring it on. Make my day. I'm ready now. I know what to do with you. I called Florence. Can I MC the melodrama? She's like, Rick, you left the stage. So I tried whining, because sometimes whining works. Like, please. She's like, all right. I go back down there. I'm praying for a heckler all the way to the theater that Friday night. I walk out on that stage, and I got exactly what I asked for. There was a guy in the front row. He took a shot at me. No sooner did I start, this guy said something really nasty to me. Probably got wind of what had happened before. Only now I'm psyched. Slowly I turned. I looked at him, and I said to him, hey, I got a great idea, pal. Let's play horse. I'll be the head. You be yourself. And that was all it took, and they just started coming out of me. All 20 of them. Bam, bam, bam. Here's the best part. The audience loved it. The guy loved it. He was actually writing them down to use on coworkers the next day. And I loved it because now I had the experience of succeeding at something. So you really have the ability to put yourself in the position of knowing what to do in the privacy of your mind in those old situations that got the best of you. It's the best way you can learn how to do these things, and it comes in really handy when you're dealing with tanks and snipers and grenades. Let's talk a little bit about the hostile sniper. You know, the hostile sniper, unlike the friendly sniper who's saying, I love you by being nasty to you, the hostile sniper is trying to undermine your control. Why? Because that way they feel like they're in control. You get that? In fact, what's one of the best ways to seize control? It's to undermine everybody else's control. Then you're the only one left standing. So the sniper has a gift. The hostile sniper learns what undermines your sense of control. How many of you right now can think of one thing that if I were to say it up here, it would offend you and you'd be tempted to leave? Just off the top of your head. One thing, if I were to say it, you'd be offended, you'd leave. You got one of those? Because the snipers learn that about you. They find out what that is, but they don't use it. They reserve it for the moment when it'll do the most damage. We're talking about really nasty things, you know, sexist jokes, racist jokes, things that really derail people. And those are the things they throw out there when you least want them to do it. So I'll give you an example of this. Rick and I, many years ago, we worked with somebody who worked for a high-tech company in Portland, Oregon. I'm going to call her Caroline. Caroline was asked by her company to be part of a cross-functional team that was given decision-making authority to improve the quality in a particular product. And the problem was there were six people on this team, and five of them were men, and one of these men had an issue with women in the workplace, you know, back in the day when that happened.
Yeah. And every time Caroline spoke up at a meeting, this one guy, Charles, would make a sexist joke. And every time he made a sexist joke, she would be offended and get derailed. She'd still try to keep going, but it didn't work anymore because it was a mixed message. And then she was suppressing all that, and she wound up with a health problem, which is how she came to us. And the way she described the problem initially was, they're all against me. And we're like, how do you know they're all against you? She said, whenever Charles makes one of these jokes, they all laugh. Well, you know what? People laugh when they're uncomfortable. I said, let's go to the cause, not the symptoms. So what's the cause here? Well, it's Charles. It's this thing he's saying. He's sniping at you. He's undermining your control, derailing you on this thing. What can you do different? And we taught her what I'm about to share with you. We taught her to stop in the middle of a word, in the middle of a sentence. Stop. Slowly I turn, step by step, inch by inch, lock on target, look them right in the eyes, and say back the thing they said to you. Now, if they're words you don't want to repeat, leave those words out. Remember keywords. That's the whole thing. But you say back the thing they said to you. We said, this is what you got to do with Charles. He makes one of those jokes. You go, Charles, I just heard you say, and repeat it back. She said, why would I do that? I said, because that's Wonder Woman right there. That's Wonder Woman going, whoop, here's your bullet. Instead of being hit by it, you caught it, and you're handing it back to him. Now, the thing you need to know about snipers when they have hostile intent, when they're trying to undermine you, is they can't believe they missed. Because this is a covert operation. And here you are doing something out in the open. Repeat after me, snipers can't snipe if snipers can't hide. Plain and simple. If you bring it out in the open, it stops working. You just bring it right out in the open, it stops working. But it takes them a couple of shots to get that. In fact, the pattern of three holds with the hostile sniper. They will take three shots before they realize that it's not working. And sure enough, he makes another joke. He goes, hey, hey, and he makes another joke. And she does it again. She goes, Charles, I just heard you say da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you turn on the searchlight. Now, there are two ways to shine a light into that covert operation. One of them you've already learned. It's the relevancy question. Everybody remember the relevancy question? What does that have to do with this? It's an indirect method of handling it, and it's my advice is to do that when you're in a group situation. You don't want to turn this into a conflict in a group. So what you do instead is you remind people what this was supposed to be about and then ask how that's relevant to it. Charles, it's my understanding the company asked us to work here together to improve the quality of this product. What does, and she repeats back his sexist jokes, have to do with improving the quality of this product? He can't believe it. He knows he missed. He takes a third shot. Again, she catches the bullet midair, hands it back to him, repeats it back. Says, Charles, you know, like I said, it's my understanding that the reason we're on this team is to find a way to improve the quality of this product. What does, and repeats back all three offensive things that he said, and says, what do those things have to do with what we're here to do? Let me ask you a question. Where do you think people are looking now? Are they looking at Caroline or are they looking at Charles? He is now exposed. He's in an exposed position. So that's one of the searchlight questions. There is another searchlight question. It's much more direct. And that's the question where you ask somebody, what are you really trying to say? When you say that, what are you really trying to say? My advice to you is do not do this when there's a group around. This is a private interaction. But if you ever find yourself using the relevancy question on a control-seeking sniper, immediately go to them after the meeting and use this other searchlight question. Because the lesson you want them to learn is, number one, you're not derailed, and number two, snipers can't snipe when snipers can't hide. You want to make this an uncomfortable choice for them to make. So, okay, so back to our story. So Caroline's in the meeting. She says this to Charles. Well, Charles now has a choice to make. He's exposed. Everybody's looking at him. He's got to decide what he wants to do, and he can make one of three choices. He could stop. He could call off the attack. He'd go, you know what? Never mind. Oh, that's a great outcome. He could, however, and this is the more common outcome, drop down out of the tree he was hiding in, land inside of a fully loaded tank, and come out guns blazing. Oh, you want to know what that has to do with it? Well, I'll tell you what that has to do with this. You're an idiot. I'm not, you know, and there you go. His third choice, however, is to be honest. And every once in a while, that's exactly what happens. You say, what does that have to do with this? And he goes, all right, I'll tell you what that has to do with this. Last month, you came into this meeting. You had an idea. You convinced everybody to go with it. You said it would save money, and it wound up costing money. And I think you lack a little credibility in offering ideas to the group. And if you're Caroline, you're thinking, why did I listen to those guys in that seminar? But instead, what I want you to do is remember, if they come out guns blazing, use the tank strategy. Now, go ahead, look at your notes. What's the first thing you do with a tank? Take a look. Go ahead and take a look. And then what do you do? And then what do you do? So that's what you do if they come out guns blazing. You switch tactics to match the behavior you're dealing with. But if they're willing to tell you what's going on, I told this to you earlier, one of the best things to do with criticism is to go deep structure on it. Bring the details to the surface. Guess what? If you say, who implemented the idea? How is the idea implemented? There's a very good chance it was Charles that did it to derail you. And just by asking those questions, you've exposed the problem. Does that make sense? So that's a wonderful thing you can do, but I'd like to complete talking about this with this one idea, that you end with a direction. You suggest a civil future. That you tell people at the end of these difficult interactions, you know, here's an idea. Next time you've got a problem with me, talk with me. I can take it. I'm interested in hearing it. I'm willing to listen. Just talk with me. Believe it or not, not everybody was raised by nice people like my mother. They don't know that a civil future is an option. You have to educate them.